talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're searching for white smoke as we explore the history of conclaves, especially the most unusual and impactful ones, as we find out how the Roman Catholic Church elects a pope. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're going behind the locked doors of the Vatican into one of the world's most secretive elections, the Papal Conclave. From the conclave that dragged on for nearly 3 years to the election of a pope on the eve of World War, these gatherings have shaped the Catholic Church and also global history itself. With another conclave to elect the successor to Pope Francis about to begin, we're going to investigate what we can learn from studying the most unusual and impactful conclaves in history.
When it comes to choosing a new pope, the process is a mix of ancient tradition, religious ritual, and politics.
Looking right now, that smoke is now coming out of the chimney. It certainly looks, it appears to be white. We have a new pope, and you can hear the cheers from St. Peter's Square out there, and you can see all of those crowds that have been gathered outside waiting for that smoke to come from inside the Sistine Chapel.
It's an enduring display we've seen throughout history, the white smoke billowing out of the Vatican Sistine Chapel, signifying the selection of a new pope, followed by a procession to the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica.
And as that smoke rose and billowed into the night air, St. Peter's Square erupted.
To help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Celeste McNamara is Assistant Professor of Early Modern History at DCU and is an expert on church history from the 16th to the 18th centuries. And she's the author of The Bishop's Burden, Reforming the Catholic Church in Early Modern Italy. Dr. Patrick Houlihan is Associate Professor in History at Trinity College Dublin and just this week was elected a Fellow of Trinity College Dublin. His research spans from World War I to the Cold War and the Holocaust, focusing on Catholic modernity, humanitarianism and the global reach of Vatican policy. And his books include Catholicism and the Great War and Religious Humanitarianism During the World Wars. Professor Massimo Fagioli is Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University in Pennsylvania in the United States and is a globally recognized expert on the history of the papacy and the Second Vatican Council. He's a regular commentator on the Church's direction and has written extensively on conclave politics, and his books include Global Catholicism, Between Disruption and Encounter. Well, you're all very welcome. And Massimo, we might begin with you and a question about why we have such global interest in papal conclaves. You know, people who aren't even particularly religious, never mind Catholic, seem to be following it. And is that partly because of the spectacle, or mainly because of the spectacle, the fact that, you know, the cardinals are locked in the room, the fact that you have the white smoke or the black smoke, that there are all of these theatrical elements to it?
Yes, there are theatrical elements. That's exactly the right word, because the papal Rome that we know is the Rome of the Baroque era, mostly. And it was built, the squares, the palaces, the churches, exactly to be a theater. That's exactly the word they used. So they understood the power of symbols. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that the papacy is a unique monarchy in the world, because it's a monarchy without a dynasty. And so that's exactly why the conclave was invented, to prevent the possibility of dynasties, or papal dynasties. And third, because there's nothing like that in the world. A religious leader who's also a head of state, who has his own diplomacy. There's the whole apparatus that's typical of a modern state, in a minuscule version, which is in the Vatican. So it's a it's a theater, but it's not just a red carpet. It's something more than that.
And is there anything new or different about this conclave that's about to take place?
I think there is, because this is, I think, the first conclave of the third millennium, even if we had the one of 2005 and 2013, because Pope Francis really came from the global south and introduced Catholicism to its global dimension. And the College of Cardinals that is now in Rome preparing for the election is the largest ever, is the most diverse ever, and it's the most unpredictable, because we have many cardinals from Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe. So it's much less dominated by the usual powers of the Catholic nations, Italy, France, Germany. And so that's really a taste of what the Catholic Church in the third millennium looks like.
And Massimo, do you think that there is this theory or belief that someone enters the conclave a pope, but they leave a cardinal, meaning that whoever is the favourite going in very rarely gets it? Does that hold up? Is being the favourite a bad thing because it means that the people who are opposed to that person then can band together to stop them?
Well, that has happened in previous conclaves in this century, for example, but we have other cases when the favorite actually became pope. Like in 1939, Pope Pius XII was the Secretary of State. Or 1963, when Paul VI was elected, he was the favorite. So it's a cautionary rule that we shouldn't assume that the favorite will be elected. But in some cases, the favorite is re-elected, so there's no certainty about any possible route. Conclaves are often full of surprises, and we should expect the unexpected. But there are, in some cases, real favorites, real candidates that are better positioned than others.
Celeste, it is extraordinary when you look back over, you know, the centuries and the way these elections kind of evolved, and even some of the procedures, and some that we'll be looking at were very short, some were very long. You know, there was one in the 13th century that went on for years.
Yeah, there were actually two in the 13th century that went on for years. But the longest in history started in 1268, and it was a particularly kind of complicated political situation. You have a lot of heads of state that are trying to interfere in the conclave, which happens throughout the medieval and early modern period. But in this particular one, the conclave meets in Viterbo, which is part of the Papal States, but they're not in Rome, because that's where the Pope had died, and that was the rule that you met where the Pope had died. And you have this kind of intractable political situation where you have factions that are not agreeing with each other. They almost elect somebody after 2 months. He's the head of a monastic order, and he does not want to become pope, so he runs away, and that prevents them from electing him. So they're still stuck. 2 years in, there's still no movement, and the people of Viterbo at that point are really annoyed. They want a new pope, and supposedly they're reacting to an English cardinal's joke that, oh, maybe we should take the roof off to let the Holy Spirit in, because, of course, it's technically the Holy Spirit who's making this decision. So the people of Viterbo take that literally and go and take the roof off the palace that they're in. The cardinals are then quite unhappy, as you might expect, and they threaten Viterbo with interdict, which basically means everybody's excommunicated. So they construct a kind of makeshift roof to close them back in and make them a little more comfortable. But it still doesn't stop the conclave. Several cardinals fall ill. Several cardinals die. Kings and princes turn up trying to put pressure on them. None of this works. So they finally have to reduce themselves to a committee of six. There were 19 going in. They're down to six, and they agree that, okay, if five of you agree, we'll take that person. And so finally the five are able to elect Gregory X at that point. But Gregory X at that point is in Syria ministering to crusaders. And so he actually isn't able to get back to Viterbo for another 6 months. And so you have no pope for 40 months in situ, and it takes, I think, 34 months even for him to be elected. So it's almost 3 years.
Almost 3 years. And Patrick, then we also have some of the shortest ones. And is the shortest one 1939?
Shortest one of the 20th century, 1939, which is, as Massimo mentioned, elected Eugenio Pacelli as Pope Pius XII. Yes.
And why was there such speed on that occasion?
Well, we can see with hindsight that the cardinals were very concerned about diplomacy and the state of the world. This was March 1939. And Eugenio Pacelli was elected in one of the shortest in history on his birthday, actually, 2nd of March, 1939. I don't know if that's ever happened in papal history before, but the conclave lasted only 2 days and 3 ballots, and this was a time of war on the horizon. Now, when did World War II begin? If we talk about what became a global war with the Japanese Empire, it could have begun in 1931 or 1937, but of course in Europe, this was the time of Nazi Germany on the march and on the rise. And the conclave elected Eugenio Pacelli, who was the Cardinal Secretary of State, very experienced in diplomacy, and who'd been experienced in diplomacy since 1917, his days as a papal nuncio to Bavaria in the First World War, where, among other things, he witnessed the rise of the Bavarian Socialist Republic, as did Adolf Hitler, who was also in Munich during this time period, and the existential threat that was also communism, too. So that's the other part of this. The papacy is having to confront authoritarian, totalitarian regimes in the world from left and right. And in March of 1939, they went with someone who knew the German world very well.
And he was someone who had this great reputation as a diplomat. They saw that, they believed that he would be the person who could steer them through this global war. But his reputation is pretty mixed and divisive. And some argue that he did a good job, others that he could have done a lot more, that he should have spoken out more. How do we evaluate his papacy?
That's a great question, and actually now we can begin to approach it historically. It's very polemical, as you've mentioned. People have very strong opinions about Pope Pius XII, one of history's most controversial popes. But now we can begin to analyze as historians, because the Vatican has opened its archives, the Apostolic Archives, in particular, but also the archives of the Secretary of State. There are multiple Vatican archives, actually, in Rome. And Papa Francesco, in March of 2019, declared that the Church is not afraid of history. So 1 year later, in March of 2020, these archives were opened for the very first time for historians. And I was there in Rome, as were other people. And it was a very interesting time, if you can remember for us, historically, March of 2020, right? A few other things happened that time. The archives were open for about a week, and then COVID closed them down. They've reopened since, and I'm part of a research group that's exploring the archives of Pope Pius XII. But now we can begin as historians to actually answer these questions. And for me, the polemical matters of Pope Pius XII, I think a lot of people, especially from outside the Catholic Church, are seeking the Nixonian kind of smoking gun, or, you know, what did he know and when did he know it? And that there are very few kind of smoking guns like that in history. And especially the turn on one concrete fact or another. The basic facts of what happened during the Second World War have largely been known for decades. But as you said, Patrick, it's people have polemical opinions about what could he or should he have done. And those really stretch the limits of history, and particularly his responsibility for what could he or should he have done regarding the Jews and the Holocaust.
And Patrick, as historians, we love paperwork. We love documents. I wonder how much paperwork is there in the archives about the conclaves, given that don't they burn the votes? And I wonder, is there anyone taking a kind of a record of things that are said or things that are discussed? Or is this really very much top secret?
Yeah, they're keeping track of the votes as they're being recorded as it happens. But then those tally sheets are also burned. But it's interesting. Some of the cardinals in history have kept a diary, which in the past has been forbidden to do canonically, but to actually record what was happening. It happened in the 1914 conclave, for instance, that elected Benedict XV, the unknown pope, also a conclave that happened directly during the First World War. But the conclaves have become a lot more secret in history. But now it's fascinating to see the Vatican opening up these records so that people can begin to examine them. And I think for Pius XII, for me as a historian, the most interesting parts are actually the post-45 period. So when the Cold War beginning and these questions of real global history. And yes, the legacy of the Shoah, the Holocaust, how did that play out, for example, in 1948 with the State of Israel. And in the midst of the Cold War, Communist China is happening too. So for me, there's a lot of really interesting historical questions that are going to be explored, especially for the post-1945 era.
Celeste, the idea of the white smoke and the black smoke, I think that was maybe, I think, first in 1878 and then became a 20th century thing. That is so much part of the imagery and the symbolism and the drama of the whole thing.
Yes, and it is basically a modern phenomenon. So in the early modern period, you would have burned the ballots because they're intended to remain secret, but the chimney might not have been in a place that the people could see. Like the conclave moves around a lot. It doesn't necessarily take place in the Vatican Palace throughout the medieval and early modern period. Sometimes they move to the Quirinale Palace because there's malaria and it's really low-lying land near the Vatican. Sometimes they're not even in Rome. So the actual architecture changes. But also, there's certainly no white or black smoke. If anything, if you can see the smoke, it's just an indication that they've had a scrutiny and they've burned the ballots. It doesn't really mean very much. But there are other signs that the conclave might have ended or that it might be coming to an end. So there's things like, did the chef order food for dinner tonight? If not, the conclave is over. They're also, prior to the 20th century, extraordinarily porous. So they're supposed to be secret. From the 13th century or 12th century, there's rules that they're supposed to be secret. Those are broken all the time. Sometimes the cardinals themselves are going in and out. There's often servants going in and out. There's a rule that each cardinal is supposed to only bring one servant. They're called conclavists, and they're kind of like a mix of secretary and personal servant. There's one conclave where there are 400 people in the conclave, and there are only about 60 cardinals at that point. So you have, dozens of and sometimes hundreds of people who are not cardinals who are in there and who have to go out to get supplies and things. And their food is coming in from the outside. There's messages being passed in bread and under plates and things. So there's very little secrecy, actually, in the early periods, because there's all this kind of secret information being passed in and out of wherever they're having the conclave. And there are times when, there's bookies outside. You can bet on who's going to become the Pope. And the bookies are very well informed. And the cardinals are often actually betting themselves. So, they're passing information to their bookie and also then placing bets.
No way, because I know that in recent years, some of the online bookmakers have been taking bets on who the next Pope would be. They even take bets on what name the Pope will take. But I thought this was very much a modern phenomenon. So you're saying going back in the medieval times...
You could walk up to wherever the conclave was, and there would be bookmakers outside taking bets with their odds, ready for you to look at and decide who you wanted to bet on. There's also the other thing I think that is kind of really interesting about the porosity of the conclaves is that, particularly in the medieval period, there's a practice of essentially looting the papal apartments after the Pope dies. So in the period of Sede Vacante, Rome is basically chaos. They release all the prisoners from jail. Everything is really chaotic. And one of the things that the people of Rome do is they go and they take all the dead Pope's things. But you start to see over the medieval period, this shifts to taking the newly elected Pope's things. So they go and they ransack the house of the cardinal who's been elected Pope. But they also sometimes get bad rumors out of the conclave. Oh, so-and-so is about to be elected or has been elected. And then this mob rushes to their house and ransacks the place. And so sometimes you go into the conclave as Pope, you come out as cardinal and without any of your things because the people of Rome have gone and taken it all.
Oh, no. Crushing. Defeat in the conclave and then having all your stuff taken on you as well. Massimo, in terms of unusual conclaves, what ones stand out for you or what cases do you think are important or significant?
The most unusual was one which was celebrated not in Rome, but in Venice in the year 1800, which is when the papacy is under a very serious threat by Napoleon. And they meet in Venice because Rome is occupied and the Pope Pius VI has died in the hands of the French. Napoleon's attack against the papacy is at the beginning of a renewal and of a triumphant papacy, which is what we see at the end of the 19th century and then in the 20th century. So conclaves take place at crucial moments, and the one of 1800 is one of those, I think.
And Massimo, I was reading that only, I think, 34 cardinals were able to make it to that conclave, and they were under incredible political pressure as well, that the Austrian emperor had his preferred candidate, and they were being put under quite a lot of pressure to pick someone who was acceptable.
Right. I mean, this factor of the political pressure from the empires or kings, that is a constant until 1903, when there is the famous last case of an emperor, in that case, the Austrian emperor, who vetoes candidate, which was one of his rights, actually, legally back then. And that's why after 1903, there is a papal law that prohibits that formally. And this prohibition has been repeated by John Paul II. So it is a constant, and now we see new forms of pressure, more indirect. There's the social media effect. There's the pressure of lobbying organizations. So the pressures are still there, but in a new form, I would say.
And Massimo, the Pope who emerged from that conclave, Pius VII, he was someone who had expressed, you know, support for democracy, saying that you could be a democrat and a good Christian, and that was hugely controversial for some at the time. It's interesting the way that in these times of crisis, it's interesting to see who emerges from it.
Absolutely. The Catholic Church has a sense of what happens in the world, and that every election in the conclave sends a certain kind of message. I mean, let's think about 1978, at the height of the Cold War, the conclave picks a very young cardinal from Poland. That was a stunning message sent to the communist world, but also to the United States, that the Vatican was looking for a new solution to the Cold War. So in 2013, a Pope from Argentina was exactly the opposite in some sense as a biography from the one of Pope Benedict. So conclaves are mysterious, but the signals that they send have a certain clarity to the world powers, to the public opinion. And that's part of this mix of the mysterious and of the political that make the conclave so interesting, even for non-Catholics.
And Patrick, you mentioned Pope Benedict, the unknown pope elected in 1914. And it's interesting, he emerged as a very significant and influential and important figure during that war, and a hugely respected figure.
Exactly. And this was a conclave that happened while the World War was going on. Pope Pius X died on the 20th of August, 1914. The German troops were marching in to Belgium at that time. So this was a conclave that happened in the midst of unfolding war. And from this unknown pope emerged, who had experience in papal diplomacy. And it was a time of intense nationalist upsurge on both sides. You had Catholics denouncing each other in nationalistic stereotypes, and in particular the French and the German Catholics. Cardinals and the bishops had an exchange of words. And they were really polemical in support of their own states. But this is these vicious national stereotypes. Benedict had to contend with that and emerged from this in really unique position, where at this time the Roman question hadn't been settled, hadn't been clarified in terms of international law. This would only culminate in the Lateran Treaty and the treaties in 1929 with Mussolini's fascist Italy. But at this time, the Holy See occupied this kind of gray zone of international law. So people were trying to use the Vatican to influence propagandistically their own diplomatic aims. And Benedict actually had to take that into account and yet rise above it. And one of the ways he did it was through his humanitarian charity, where in difficult war times, he put his money where his mouth was. He nearly bankrupted the Vatican's liquidity, putting out aid for POWs, or orphans, widows, and really, I've seen the files in the Vatican archives. They are all kinds of petitions asking the Holy Father, begging for money. This is coming in from all over the world, and quite frankly, it's wartime. So communication channels are difficult to do, and the bishops' ad limina visits stop. So the Vatican's liquidity is drying up, and Benedict XV nearly bankrupted doing that. One of his most famous initiatives on that front is his support for the Save the Children Fund. And he was able to rise above the propagandistic bickering and come out as a peacemaker. His August 1917 peace initiative was basically usurped by Woodrow Wilson, who took some of the 14 points from what Benedict was saying. And Wilson was this very messianic leader, so he wouldn't share the world stage with anyone. But Benedict was the real peacemaker and had risen above the fighting of the war. War had given birth to revolution, counter-revolution. There was chaos in Europe, mass starvation, million death, and the Allies landing troops in Russia trying to exterminate the Bolshevik experiment. So war was continuing, and through it all, Benedict helped support and contributed money to feeding starving children, which was kind of this amazing moment for diplomacy. And it happened in this time period where the church, before 1914, was really involved in state power, and then in 1929 would clarify its status too. So it was this really unique moment. And I think Benedict XV is an unknown pope, but I think more people should learn about him.
And kind of surprising then that Joseph Ratzinger, who wouldn't have had that kind of reputation as a great reformer, a great visionary like that, that he also chose the name Benedict.
That's right. And he did so explicitly because he wanted to be acknowledged as a peacemaker. And that's what his intent and was trying to do. But also, I think for Ratzinger as Benedict XVI, he was drawing on the European tradition of monasticism in the long term, going back to Benedict and really talking about, having to European society go inward and the monastic preservation of European cultural values, that refocusing inward and then go outward.
Well, tonight we are talking history, and we're talking about papal conclaves throughout history, looking at some of the most interesting and unusual. I'm going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be finding out about some of the politicking that goes on. So stay with us here on News Talk.
He is with God. Sede vacante. The throne of the Holy See is vacant.
Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are looking at papal conclaves across history. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Celeste McNamara, Assistant Professor of Early Modern European History at DCU, and she's the author of The Bishop's Burden, Reforming the Catholic Church in Early Modern Italy, Dr. Patrick Houlihan, Associate Professor in History and a newly elected Fellow of Trinity College Dublin, who's the author of Catholicism and the Great War and Religious Humanitarianism During the World Wars, and Professor Massimo Fagioli, who's Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University, a globally recognized expert on the papacy and the author of Global Catholicism, Between Disruption and Encounter. Massimo, I'd like to clarify, first of all, who can actually be elected pope? Because we have it in our heads that it always has to be a cardinal, but the rules don't actually say that.
They don't say that. They do say that it has to, if the person who is elected is not a bishop, he has to be an ordained bishop on the spot, which is incredibly unlikely, but that's one of the, it's an election that has to choose someone who is able to assume the task of being the bishop of Rome. And so there are some canonical requirements, but the main purpose of the conclave when it's created between the 11th century and the 13th century was not to choose a cardinal per se, but was to keep out of the selection process the influence of the powerful Roman families. And so that's how the conclave starts. And so cardinals are just instrumental to preserve the freedom of the election of the Bishop of Rome, because this is how bishops were elected in the first millennium, with the process of creating consensus among an assembly of people. So it has become right now very focused on cardinals, but this is not how it started, because many bishops in the early church were not chosen among those who had made a specific career to become a bishop, and the Diocese of Rome has preserved in a very strange way that early Christian history way of choosing bishops.
And Massimo, how important is the conclave now, given that you have such incredible communication technology that cardinals can be in touch with each other, that I wonder if the most important period is now the period before the conclave actually starts, because that's where you can be doing all of this politicking and you can be negotiating and making deals and canvassing. And is there a huge amount of activity taking place before they actually meet formally?
Yes, there is. And that takes place not just among cardinals, because we know that in Rome these days have arrived many other important influencing people, like major donors of Catholic organizations want to talk to some cardinals and make a case for a particular direction of the conclave. There are, of course, intelligence agencies want to understand what's going on in the Catholic Church. Embassies have always been part of this circuit of informal gatherings in the days before the cardinals have to be in a secluded place. So the movie Conclave, I liked it because it gives us a sense of drama, but it's also very much focused on the voting days, on the cardinals only, but there's a larger world that it takes place, especially until the day when the cardinals leave. There's much more going on that is underreported or that is actually kept under wrap because it's really part of how you influence not to be too public on who you meet and what you talk about.
And given that the numbers voting are actually quite small, it is possible to contact, to talk to everyone that, you know, I wonder in the years before a pope dies, do you have ambitious candidates talking, making friends, making contacts, trying to build up a lot of support or enough votes that they'll at least enter the conclave in a very strong position? Or is it frowned upon to be looking like you're that ambitious?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you have to be able to create a certain network of contacts and a relationship. But at the same time, it was part of the handbook of the cardinals in the early modern period that you couldn't show too much that you were ambitious. I mean, that was so it's a mix of ambition. It is an art to create a certain circle, but to disguise it in a language of humility, of I'm not worthy, I'm not. It was really, in some sense, a real theater because it. So there's a human drama, and it's a process of choosing a person in the end, not a platform, not a program, but in the end, it's a person. So there is an element of human relationship that cannot be really measured in terms of your CV or your statements. It's part of the fascination of the conclave.
Celeste, we've mentioned that you don't have to be a cardinal, and it was an archbishop who was chosen in 1378 in what has been described as a crazy compromise. And that was a remarkable conclave, an extraordinary result, and in the end, in the long run, hugely damaging for the church.
Yes. So in 1378, the papacy has just re-arrived in Rome. So it's been in Avignon in France for about 70 years at that point. And Gregory the 11th brings the kind of papal court back to Rome, but then he dies very shortly after he arrives. And so he knows that this is about to be a very difficult conclave. And so while he's ill, he tells the cardinals, ignore the rules, get out of Rome, move as much as you have to. You do not need the two-thirds majority, just get this done. And they ignore him. And so he dies and they meet in Rome. It's in the Vatican Palace. And almost immediately there's a mob of Romans outside who are demanding a Roman pope, or at the very least an Italian one. And the cardinals don't know what to do, that this angry mob is outside and they can't now leave. They realize they should have gone out of Rome to do this, but they're just stuck. And essentially, the Romans are just tired of the papacy being in Avignon. They want it to stay, and they think a Roman will keep it there. And so they decide to trick the Roman people, and they decide to pretend that they have elected a Roman cardinal just to get these people to disperse, and then maybe they can move or at least have a bit more peace to do this election. And so they hold up this very elderly, quite sickly Roman cardinal to the window as if to signal to the people, here's our choice, and you know he's one of yours. They haven't actually elected him. They don't say Habemus Papam. They just kind of prop this guy up in a window. And immediately a large part of the crowd disperses and goes and ransacks his house. They then meet again. Now that the mob outside is at least quieter, they think they've gotten their way. And they elect, as you say, the Archbishop of Bari, who becomes Urban VI. And it's a little unclear what they thought was going to happen. Some people think maybe they had made a deal with him that he would abdicate once they got out of there so that they could then go and have a better election somewhere else. Others say maybe they thought he would be a kind of puppet pope, that the College of Cardinals could sort of control him until, you know, a kind of caretaker, essentially. But he is neither. And he is actually very keen on having that power and also turns out to have quite a temper. And so within 2 months, most of the cardinals who have elected him have fled. They've left Rome. They've gone back up to Avignon. And within a few more months, more of the cardinals fled. And by the end of the summer, only, I think, one cardinal is left in Rome, and he's just too ill to travel. So it's not that he wanted to stay. And so they get together and then they say, okay, this person is not the pope. They declare him deposed. He takes no notice of this. And they hold a new conclave. And so then they elect Clement VII as the new pope. But Urban VI has not accepted that he is no longer the pope. And so now we have two popes. And Urban VI then just goes about naming a whole bunch of new cardinals. So now he has his own College of Cardinals around him. And so we have a divided papacy at this point. And when each one of them dies, the cardinals around them just go on and say, well, ours was the real pope, so we will elect a new one. And so you have this period of two popes for quite a while. The first attempt to fix this is in 1409, where some cardinals from both factions arrive in Pisa to try and sort this out. Neither pope will come. And so it is just the cardinals who are there trying to make an agreement. And they decide to depose both popes and to elect a third one.
This is the best way. That's the brilliant solution.
And, well, you know, you can't ask one of them to step down and not the other, right? So they both, again, ignore this and refuse to step down. And they elect yet another pope. And so now we have three popes. So we have Alexander V in Pisa. And then we still have a Roman pope and an Avignon pope. Now we have three popes. And, of course, all of Europe has sort of divided itself based on political alliances and political kind of goals to follow one pope or the other. So they all have a following. And there are people who think each one of them is the real pope, but nobody really knows who is the real pope. So this is finally sort of solved at the Council of Constance, which starts in 1414, ends in 1417, and which is actually called by the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pisan Pope, right, who is John XXIII, who is the most notorious of what will later become the anti-popes because he was reputed to have committed all sorts of heinous crimes. So the first thing the Council of Constance does with regards to the popes is to depose John XXIII, who has called the council. But then they also say, okay, we can get Gregory to step down, to abdicate. And the last pope, the Avignon pope, is Benedict. And so they try to get Benedict to step down as well. But Benedict goes and says, well, if we don't know who the pope was since 1378, then anyone who's been made a cardinal since 1378 is probably not really a cardinal. So all cardinals made post-1378 also have to step down, and then I'll step down as pope. Now, the trick is he's the only cardinal who was a cardinal before 1378. So what he's essentially argued for is I get to pick the next pope. Like, I'll step down, but then I'm going to elect one myself. The cardinals, of course, are not going to agree to that. So that doesn't work. And they just shoot back and say, well, we already deposed you in 1409, so we're not listening to you anymore. And they ultimately then elect yet another pope, Martin V. The Roman pope and the Pisan pope are now out of the picture. That's fine. But the Avignon pope is still claiming to be pope. They still re-elect another Avignon pope after him. But 6 years after he's elected, he finally submits to Martin V. And this is sort of over, except for one French cardinal who refuses to let this go and elects yet another French pope who lives until the mid-15th century. We don't really know much about him because nobody follows him, but it's not technically over, I guess, in the strictest sense, until the mid-15th century. So it is this huge rupture. and a huge moment of confusion for the Catholic Church. Ultimately, in retrospect, the Church declares the Roman line to have been the legitimate line, and all of the Pisan and Avignon popes are designated as anti-popes. But this even still has a knock-on effect in papal politics for a very long time, including into the 20th century, because how do you use those names again? So a pope who picks a name from the Roman line and then picks the next number is sort of reifying the Roman line as real, and a pope who reuses an anti-pope's name is then declaring that pope invalid. And the last one to be sort of declared that way is John the 23rd. So I think because he was so notorious in the time, nobody wanted to touch that name until the 20th century.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I never really fully understood the idea of the anti-pope before. And it's interesting what you say as well about a two-thirds majority, because I had kind of forgotten that when we were talking. And I was thinking, oh, you needed 70. But of course, in this conclave, you'll need more. You'll need 90 or something for the two-thirds. What's the logic behind that? Is it just to ensure that there is broad support for the candidate? Is it to ensure that, you know, maybe there's suspicion of just a straight majority?
Yes, it's just to make sure that there is a real kind of consensus or something approaching consensus in the College of Cardinals. It also, you have to remember that in the early medieval and early modern period, conclaves are much, much smaller. So some of them barely have 20 people. The normal kind of limit is set at various points at 60 or 70. So it's also only in the 20th century that you get much larger conclaves as more cardinals are appointed around the world. Because, of course, in the pre-modern period, they're all European. And so you need to make sure that no one faction can control things either, because in every conclave you have the Roman faction, the Italian faction, the Spanish faction, the imperial faction, and you don't want any of them to be able to completely control an election and push somebody over the edge. Of course, if they, you know, come together, then they can. But it's a way to make sure that it requires more consensus across at least the European powers.
Well, extraordinary times. And will we have a similar controversy and similar excitement with this approaching conclave? We're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be finding out about some of the other more unusual conclaves in history. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we are preparing for the conclave by talking about some of the most unusual conclaves in history. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Dr. Celeste McNamara of DCU, Dr. Patrick Houlihan of Trinity College Dublin, and Professor Massimo Fagioli of Villanova University. Patrick, tell me about some of these political considerations, the global political considerations in the 20th century when popes have to kind of navigate what's going on and maybe how that might impact on a conclave or how a pope is selected.
Sure. Well, one of the things that shows the global reach and the digital progress that the world has made, and very different from the world of 1914, right, where this is a media event. We're much more in touch globally now. Communication is much quicker. In the early 20th century, the travel was much more onerous. And in fact, many American cardinals especially were arriving late to the conclave and were excluded. They simply weren't arriving in time. The travel time was too great. So thankfully, well, this has been corrected and now the full participation, but you can see the globalization of the cardinal electorate that's happened in the 20th century. And the 20th century, right, has seen some remarkable shifts in terms of, political pressures, right? Massimo mentioned the jus exclusive veto of the Emperor of Austria in the 1903 conclave, immense political pressure that was deployed at that conclave. And this notion of political pressure, I think, is really something that, well, we all should think about, especially in our hyper-partisan political times, right? And what does it really mean? Of course, we all think our politics are right. It's never, you know, the other side never has a point, right? It's and we're 100%, we're almost totalitarian and absolutist in our own political views. But what does it really mean to try to have more global responsibility for decision making? And heavy is the burden of leadership for universalistic institutions to try to rise above that partisanship. So, it caused immense stress during the papacies in both the First World War and the Second World War, where there were cardinals in various constituencies, you know, screaming for their own national state causes. Now, what came to be what the papal diplomacy during both the First and the Second World War tried to develop was this notion of impartiality. And I think that's really worth considering, right? There are impartiality and neutrality, and we casually toss these words off, and we like to believe that we're all impartial and neutral, but are we really? And, you know, to the extent that we have to get involved and make decisions and commit, you know, what does this really mean? Impartiality and neutrality. Now, the Vatican was quite clear developing these lines, saying that it was not neutral, it was impartial, in fact. And so neutrality, right? What does it mean today, even within the European Union? Well, there are some neutral members of the nation of the European Union, like Ireland and Austria, that are neutral countries within a larger, you know, defensive security apparatus. And in the Second World War, you know, the United States on the 11th of March 1941 was a neutral power, but that's the date that they signed the Lend-Lease Act. Now, was that an act of a neutral power? Probably not. I mean, it was, in fact, being more impartial, and they were, Lend-Lease was leasing destroyers and bases, but to the British. I mean, they weren't cashing into Nazi Germany at this point. No. It was in their own defensive interests, and they were taking a side, choosing a cause. So what this meant in terms of how the papacy reacted, they lent towards, it's not simply a neutrality, you know, helping no one, absolving. They are trying to do this with reference to impartiality and a higher standard. And the question, I mean, it comes up, right? It's something more like a football referee, right? I mean, you simply, you can't absolve yourself totally. I mean, you have to get involved and you try to do it by a higher standard of interpreting the rules, but you are impartial. And this is what both Benedict XV and Pius XII are about during the wars. And it's absolutely immense, this weight of leadership. I mean, when I was in Rome in March of 2020, first time in the archives, I was looking at a document. It was in the files of the Secretary of State. And this was a letter that Pius XII wrote to Cardinal Michael von Faulhaber in Munich, in Germany. And it was written on the 2nd of February, 1943, which is when some remnants of the German Sixth Army were surrendering at Stalingrad, right? And I mean, just think of the historical moment in time, too. So much of the Holocaust was happening in 1942, 43, into 44. And really, into 1943, it looked as if Nazi Germany would win the war. I mean, can we just imagine that, right? It looked like the Nazi Empire. Talk about a new Nero and the kind of dark empire that history can't even imagine, a Nazi empire. But it looked until 1943 like Nazi Germany would win the war. And so Pius XII is writing to Faulhaber on 2nd of February 1943, and he's talking about we, and he's using the royal we, because he meaning himself, right? We are impartial. We're not neutral. And he's referencing it in terms of his own personal diplomacy since his days as a papal nuncio back in Munich in 1917. And this was his rationale for trying to stay above the hyper partisanship too. But it raises these questions of, you know, to what extent we should get involved, and what, at what point do you really have to take sides? And these are not easy questions, but I think they deserve more thoughtful reflection, and especially for leaders of immense responsibility that thankfully most of us don't have to carry that burden of responsibility.
Massimo, some scholars say that the conclave in the summer of 1963 was the most important one of the 20th century, because there it was going to decide whether the reforms of Pope John the 23rd with the Second Vatican Council would continue, or whether the church would go in a completely different direction.
That's true, also because it's a very particular situation from a legal, canonical point of view, because when the Pope dies, the Ecumenical Council of the Catholic Church stop and is actually suspended. So at that time, what's particular is that technically it's the conclave of the cardinals, which elects Paul the Sixth 18 days after Pope John the 23rd dies. But politically, it's the Second Vatican Council, which was behind the College of Cardinals, which elects Paul VI with the task, which was very open, to continue Vatican II, on which, when he was Archbishop of Milan at the beginning, Montini was a little skeptical, but in the first session of 1962, he becomes one of those who was clearly in favor of continuing Vatican II, and And that's why the conclave of June 63 is unique, because he was the natural candidate in some sense, but the real momentum came not just from the favor that John the 23rd accorded to him, but from the fact that the overarching moment in the Catholic Church was the Second Vatican Council. And so you have that there's a mix of different legitimacies behind a papal election. Yes, there has to be a majority of the cardinals who vote for a candidate, but there's also an ecclesial sense of the moment. And in 63 was the Second Vatican Council, and we will see what kind of ecclesial sense or political momentum there is in the conclave of May 2025.
Very good. And finally, Celeste, I might leave the last word to you. As we've looked through all these interesting, unusual, significant, impactful conclaves, is there one that stands out or anything that we've missed that you think we should leave our listeners with as a good story or a good way of framing some of these issues?
Sure. I actually might go back to the Conclave of 1241, which is the first one that is under lock, or cum clave, which is where we get the word conclave from. Just means that they're locked in. So this is after the death of Gregory the Ninth, and this is in the midst of a protracted conflict between the papacy and the papal states and the Holy Roman Emperor. And so this is a very tense time for the Pope to have died. And so the senator of Rome, the head of the Roman government, actually locks all of the cardinals into a dilapidated building as an attempt to encourage them to be very quick. And so this is the first time we have the cardinals actually locked in. They're not having much luck. They're not making a decision. So he starts threatening them with violence. He stops having the latrines cleaned. He starts making it even more uncomfortable, which is hard to imagine, given that it was a dilapidated building. And so they finally, this is also making the Romans angry. And so the Romans, actually, the people of Rome, threaten to exhume Gregory the Ninth and make him make decisions if they won't make a decision to choose a new pope. So if you won't give us a live pope, we'll use the dead one instead. And this finally does convince them to actually make a choice. The person they choose, who becomes Celestine IV, dies 17 days later. So they are back in conclave almost immediately. The next conclave takes 18 months to decide, and then they finally elect Innocent IV. But this is both the first time that they are under lock and key, and it is also the first sort of hint at practices that will be actually put into place as rules after the longest conclave, the 1268 to 71 conclave, when Gregory the X, after that conclave, says that there are now going to be rules, that it's going to be locked in, and that it has to be encouraged to be quick. So in order to encourage cardinals to make a decision quickly, they are given decreasing rations. So after 5 days, they're down to bread, wine, and water. And they are also not allowed to collect their incomes while they are in conclave. So it's a real attempt to get them to make a decision quickly. And yet, of course, as we see, we have lots of very long conclaves in the pre-modern period, so it doesn't always work. The rules are also not always followed.
The rules are not always followed. Well, that's a brilliant note, I think, on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my absolutely wonderful panel of experts for bringing the history of conclaves so wonderfully to life for us. Dr. Celeste McNamara, Dr. Patrick Houlihan, and Professor Massimo Fagioli. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my brilliant producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, for putting tonight's show together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.